Still, the Prime Minister is not smiling. He's looking very serious as he gazes around the House chamber. Now, here he is.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Congress, this is the third time it has been my fortune to address the Congress of the United States upon our joint affairs. I am honored indeed by these experiences, which I believe are unique for one who is not an American citizen. It is also a great value to me, on again becoming the head of His Majesty's government, to come over here and take counsel with many trusted friends and comrades of former anxious days. There is a lot for us to talk about together so that we can understand each other's difficulties, feelings, and thoughts, and do our best for the common cause. Let us therefore serve.
I am very glad that whatever diplomatic divergences there may be from time to time about procedure, you do not allow the Chinese anti-communists on Formosa to be invaded and massacred from the mainland. We welcome your patience in the armistice negotiations, and our two countries are agreed that if the truce we seek is reached only to be broken, our response will be prompt, resolute, and effective. What I have learnt over here convinces me that British and United States policy in the Far East will be marked by increasing harmony. I can assure you that our British hearts go out in sympathy to the families of the 100,000 Americans who have given their lives or shed their blood in Korea. We also suffer these pangs for the loss of our own men there, and not only there, but in other parts of Asia as well, under the attack by the same enemy. Whatever course events in Korea may take in the near future, and prophesy would be difficult, much too difficult for me to embark upon it, I am sure our soldiers and your soldiers have not made their sacrifice in vain. The cause of world law has found strong and invaluable defense, and the foundations of the world instrument for preserving peace, justice, and freedom among the nations have been deepened and strengthened. They stand now not on paper, but on rock. Moreover, the action which President Truman took in your name and with your full support in his stroke against aggression in Korea has produced consequences far beyond Korea, consequences which may well affect the destiny of mankind. The vast process of American rearmament, in which the British Commonwealth and Empire will play their part to the utmost of their strength, this vast process has already altered the balance of the world, and may well, if we all persevere steadfastly and loyally together, avert the danger of a third world war, or the horror and of defeat and subjugation should one come upon us. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, I hope the mourning families throughout the great republic will find some comfort and some pride in these thoughts. Another extraordinary change has taken place in the Far East since I last addressed you. Peace has been made with Japan. There indeed I congratulate you upon the policy which, in wise and skillful hands, has brought the Japanese nation from the woe and shame of defeat in their wicked war back to that association with the Western democracies upon which the revival of their traditions, dignity, and happiness can alone be regained and the stability of the Far East assured. In the anxious and confused expanses of Southeast Asia, there is another sphere where our aims and interests and those of the French who are fighting bravely at heavy cost to their strength in Europe may find a fertile field for agreement on policy. I feel sure that the conversations we have had between our two foreign secretaries, Mr. Eden and Mr. Acheson, men whose names and experience are outstanding throughout the world, will help to place the problems of Southeast Asia in their right setting. It would not be helpful to the common cause, for our evils all spring from one center, if an effective truce in Korea led only to a transference of communist aggression to these other fields. Our problems will not be solved unless they are steadily viewed and acted upon as a whole, in their integrity as a whole. In the Middle East, enormous changes have also taken place since I was last in power in my own country. When the war ended, the Western nations were respected and predominant throughout these ancient lands. And there were quite a lot of people who had other words to say about Great Britain. Today, it is a somber and confusing scene. Yet there is still sunshine as well as shadow. From the days of the Balfour Declaration, I have desired that the Jews should have a national home, and I worked for that end. I rejoice to pay my tribute here to the achievements of those who have founded the Israelite state, who have defended themselves with tenacity, and who offer asylum to great numbers of Jewish refugees. I hope that with their aid, they may convert deserts into gardens. But if they are to enjoy peace and prosperity, they must strive to renew and preserve their friendly relations with the Arab world, without which widespread misery might swallow all. Britain's power to influence the fortunes of the Middle East and guard it from aggression is far less today, now that we have laid aside our imperial responsibility for India and its armies. It is no longer for us alone to bear the whole burden of maintaining the freedom of the famous waterway of the Suez Canal. That has become an international rather than a national responsibility. I welcome the statesmanlike conception of a four-power approach to Egypt announced by the late British government, in which Britain, the United States, France, and Turkey may share with Egypt in the protection of the world interests involved, among which Egypt's own interests are paramount. 50,000 troops in the Suez Canal, who again might be well employed elsewhere, not for national vainglory or self-seeking advantage, but in the common interest of all nations. We do not seek to be masters of Egypt. We are there only as the servants and guardians of the commerce of the world. It would enormously aid us in our task if even token forces of the other partners in the four-power proposal were stationed in the canal zone as a symbol of the unity of purpose which inspires us. And I believe it is no exaggeration to state that such token forces would probably bring into harmony all that movement by which the four-power policy may be made to play a decisive part by peaceful measures and bring to an end the wide disorders of the Middle East, in which, let me assure you, there lurk dangers not less great than those which the United States have stemmed in Korea. Now I come to Europe, where the greatest of all our problems and dangers lie. I have long worked for the cause of United Europe, and even of a United States of Europe, which would enable that continent, the source of so much of our culture, ancient and modern, and the parent of the new world, to resume and revive its former splendors. It is my sure hope and conviction that European unity will be achieved, and that it will not ultimately be limited only to the countries at present composing Western Europe. I said it in Zurich in 1946 that France should take Germany by the hand and lead her back into the family of nations, and thus end the thousand-year quarrel which has torn Europe to pieces and finally plunged the whole world twice over into slaughter and havoc. Real and rapid progress is made, is being made, towards European unity. And it is both the duty and the policy of both Great Britain and our Commonwealth and...